Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone phone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Dr. Messner, please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Krista, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, How Healthcare Disparities May Influence Your Cancer Treatment. It's a very important program today, and I think you're going to learn a lot of things that will be helpful to you as you navigate your care. Today's program is supported by GlaxoSmithKline and a grant from Genentech, and we thank them for their support to this program. Now, before I introduce our first speaker, I just want to mention a few things about all of you on the call. We have over 150 participants on the call today. You come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, the Philippines, South Africa, and the United Kingdom. So it's really a global call. And we're delighted to have all of you spending the next hour with us to address this important topic. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Kelly Haviland. And Dr. Haviland is Advanced Practice Provider Manager, Professional Development, Advanced Practice Providers, LGBTQI plus clinical consultant, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Haviland will be addressing the disproportionate burden of COVID and cancer on people of color, effect of COVID on healthcare systems, how race may impact your access to cancer treatment, management of treatment side effects and pain management, and access to cancer treatment in the LGBTQI plus community. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Haviland.
Hi, folks. Kelly Haviland. Thanks so much for that lovely introduction. And I'm very honored to be here and talk about some of these extremely important areas that we all should be paying attention to as healthcare providers. And then you as caregivers, families of choice, and patients. I think what we learned, and we probably knew already for those of us who are members of the healthcare community, is that there are quite a bit of vulnerabilities that prohibit people to accessing cancer care. You know, we talk about a lot of times targeted treatment for cancer, meaning that we look at the type of cancer one has, the type of cells one have, and we target therapy in order to really attack that cancer the most appropriately. And I think so often we haven't in our healthcare system really looked at cancer for an entire individual as well, and include patients' age, weight, their socioeconomic status, ethnicity, race, gender identity, sexual orientation. And we haven't necessarily looked at all of these identities or characteristics of people and identified plans for targeted treatment of patients. Now, when I say that, I mean looking at what are the specific interventions one may need. And you heard in my introduction that my area of expertise is taking care of LGBTQI plus patients. Now, why is that important? You may not ever know the identity of somebody in one of those communities or populations. So we know from much research that when patients don't feel safe, and this goes across the board for multiple identities and marginalized populations, when they don't feel safe disclosing who they are, then they don't feel safe being treated by our practitioners. So when I walk into a office, it's so important for me to feel safe and trust that you are going to understand and explore who I am as a person. And these are aspects that help influence how successful our treatment is for cancer care. So during COVID, we saw a large amount of disproportionate health outcomes for patients. So a disproportionate amount of people had poorer or worse health outcomes. We also know that people of marginalized populations were much less likely to present for cancer screening, and that there were lower rates of that indicated in our research. So when we have those lower rates of participation in cancer screening or coming to get their cancer treatment, the outcome, unfortunately, is poor health outcomes, whether that be a delayed treatment for cancer or delayed screening. Those are some of those examples. And then, unfortunately, we can see higher rates of treatment side effects and pain, and some of the sequela, some of the aspects of cancer that can harm patients. So higher rates of pain not being reported to our providers. We look at addressing some of these from the healthcare arena and the healthcare perspective by really, again, addressing the individual characteristics that make up somebody, make up a person. Who are you and what's important to you? What is your race? What is your ethnicity? What is your sexual orientation, gender identity? And collecting these data so that we can actually be able to provide targeted interventions based on who a person is. Unfortunately, in the LGBTQI plus population, our U.S. Census doesn't collect those data. The U.S. Census doesn't collect sexual orientation or gender identity as a demographic. So we run into not having data to be able to provide these targeted interventions or the research to be able to provide interventions for the specific populations. So when that happens, without the data, without the research, we don't quite know what the issues are and the problems are. And these have been traditionally unseen throughout many of the marginalized populations that I just mentioned, that I've been mentioning. And so then we lack resources for our patients. And then we just completely have an unseen population. These people don't exist in our society. And so I think some of the newer care models that have been important in this arena include the enhancing oncology module that was launched by the Center for Medicaid. And that really prioritizes access to care for patients and provides important resources and initiatives for health equity across the board. And encourages institutions in our communities, oncology institutions in our communities, to be accountable and develop plans specific to address inequities, payment incentives, and require participant redesign activities of our current methods of creating access to care for our patients and how we can deliver care to our patients, as well as considering each patient's unique needs and assessing those unique needs for our patients, and then integrating our patients' voices into their care. What, you know, asking questions that may not be traditionally asked by providers, not just focusing on disease and what are your symptoms and pathology or what's wrong or side effects for your cancer in terms of, you know, specific side effects that you may, you know, not like nausea or vomiting, but actually focusing on what are the emotional aspects of your cancer care, your cancer treatment. What are the what are the specific psychological effects? What are the impediments to getting to and from your cancer treatment? What are the specific needs of survivors after you've received cancer treatment for each person individually? And I think that the current cancer moonshot initiative by Biden really seeks to look at a sooner diagnosis for all patients and addressing, again, these inequities in all patients individually and targeting the right treatment for the right patient, which I think the overall goal is to really decrease cancer by 50% with the Cancer Moonshot Initiative, and then to support the caregivers, patients, and families of choice, all of these, and the survivors, all of these groups, and not just one during treatment. And then to learn and learn from patients, learn from you as caregivers, and learn what the and listen to what is important to all of you, so that we can provide those needed resources for all. And I believe I may be at my time, so I can turn it back over to Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Heavlin. That was just a superb presentation, stellar. And actually, as the first speaker, you set the stage for today's program. So thank you so much. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. You've raised some really important issues, and I think that our participants will be having questions for you. No question about that. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Maria Chi. And Dr. Chi is clinical oncology social worker, author and researcher, healthcare disparities, social determinants of health, psychosocial oncology, and financial toxicity. And Dr. Chi will be addressing social determinants of health, including languages spoken and health literacy, influence of the local and regional environments in which you live on your access to oncology care, costs of housing and cancer treatment, food and pharmacy deserts, food insecurity, tips to increase your access to health promoting nutrition, work, community commitments, and transportation to treatment, and your rights under the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA, and Family Medical Leave Act, FMLA. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Chi.
Social determinants of health are conditions in our environment, such as where we were born and raised, and our environment now, where we live, where we go to work and school, even where we may get our cancer treatment and other health care. These aspects of our environment are important because they affect our quality of life and health outcomes, both our risk of getting certain diseases and how well we do with them once we get them. There are about five main categories of social determinants of health. The first is economic factors, meaning our ability to earn a steady income and our access to job opportunities. Our neighborhood, which is our immediate environment and access to things like clean water, safe housing, and transportation. Social and community factors, such as our exposure to certain structural inequalities, discrimination, or disparities versus opportunities to participate in meaningful social activities. The fourth is healthcare factors, including our access to nutritious food and places for physical activity or exercise. And finally, there are educational factors, our access to quality schools, access to education and reading materials in our primary language, and our community's literacy rates, including health literacy. In particular, having access to education and medical information in our primary language affects our ability to access certain procedures, such as breast or colon cancer screenings. Language barriers may also lead to miscommunication between patients and healthcare providers, which can affect the quality and safety of our care. Health literacy is the degree to which we can find, understand, and use health-related information to make healthcare decisions. Our hospitals and treatment centers also have a responsibility to ensure access to material and services that we can actually use. For example, are there pamphlets and brochures or information on their websites at a level that most of us can understand without too much medical jargon or confusing explanations? Are they offered in our primary language? Unfortunately, we do know that lower health literacy is associated with more hospitalizations and overall poorer health status. One thing you can do on a personal level is to advocate for yourself. Ask your healthcare provider if your clinic has an interpreter service, either in person or by phone, that can facilitate your visit. Now, referring back to another type of social determinant of health, your immediate environment and housing conditions. We know that in most areas of the country, both mortgages and rents have risen faster than incomes have grown. Rising housing expenses, whether you're a renter or a homeowner, can contribute to bankruptcy, foreclosure, or even homelessness if you're also facing the costs of expensive cancer treatment. One of the most stressful circumstances you may face as a person with cancer is the wide range of expenses incurred by everyday needs and major medical costs. We know, for example, you still owe your monthly rent or mortgage payment when you're going through treatment. You may have to borrow from family or friends, dip into your savings, cut back on other necessities, or even go into medical debt. One thing you may do is talk to your landlord or creditor about temporarily reducing your rental or mortgage payments or arranging a payment plan or other accommodations. You may also check with your county social services department regarding emergency rental assistance programs, ask local churches or religious organizations, or your hospital social worker for resources. At the same time as housing costs are rising, the cost of cancer treatment itself has continued to rise in the U.S. Not only is cancer the second most expensive disease in terms of overall healthcare costs, but it is personally very expensive for the person getting treatment. Newer chemotherapy options, oral medications, targeted agents, immunotherapy, et cetera, come with huge price tags. In some cases, treatment can cost as much as $100,000 each year for someone with cancer. And having health insurance may or may not significantly reduce those costs. While your health insurance plan may cover the bulk of your medication or treatment expenses, you most likely have frequent copays, coinsurance responsibilities, high premiums, or deductibles. You may find yourself going into debt to pay for treatment. Unfortunately, the financial burden of cancer disproportionately affects younger people, people with lower incomes, and people of color. There are nonprofit organizations that may help pay for cancer treatment, usually chemotherapy or oral medications, or their associated insurance copays. Organizations like the Patient Advocate Foundation, Cancer Care's Copayment Assistance Foundation, HealthWell Foundation, Patient Access Network Foundation. Another social determinant of health has to do with food insecurity or not having consistent access to safe, nutritious food, which in turn can make chronic health problems worse. This affects approximately 41 million Americans. Related to food insecurity are so-called food and pharmacy deserts. Basically, these are neighborhoods with very few pharmacies and grocery stores or markets where you may have to travel a long way to reach them. Technically, this would be more than half a mile in the city and more than 10 miles in a rural area. As we know, if you're homebound, have mobility issues, or are immunocompromised, this can make access to pharmacies and grocery stores even harder. Again, there are some programs that can help reduce this barrier, things like Meals on Wheels, local food banks, or SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Now, previously, I mentioned the challenge of accessing food or medicine because of limited transportation or distance. Certainly, transportation issues also play a significant role in getting to medical appointments and cancer treatment. It's estimated that Americans living in rural areas of the country live an average of 10.5 miles from the nearest hospital, which is approximately twice as far as it is for people in cities and suburbs. And overall, about 18% of Americans live over 10 miles away from the nearest hospital. sometimes people living in these areas travel almost three times as far as people in cities to get things like radiation. This sometimes is called travel burden or not having access to adequate transportation to medical centers, which can result in delays in treatment and diagnosis. First, to improve access to your appropriate care, there are several things that you can do, and that includes, again, contacting your hospital, clinic, healthcare center, and asking for a patient navigator, nurse care manager, case manager, social worker, or resource specialist that may help you find special programs for travel or transportation grants. Sometimes local and national nonprofit organizations like Cancer Care can offer some grants to help with transportation costs. Some even help with the cost of airfare if you need to fly out of state for treatment. Other programs help people with the cost of lodging when you're staying far from home. Check with your insurance company. A limited number of private health insurance companies and more commonly Medicaid plans may offer non-emergency medical transportation to your healthcare appointments via ambulance or car service. Now, a high travel burden may lead to a harder time meeting job commitments as you need to take more time off from work in order to get to your faraway medical appointments. You may not have enough paid time off to accommodate the frequent travel, often over many months, that is required for many types of treatment. In turn, you may lose income or jeopardize your job by taking unpaid sick or personal days. Rather than delay or avoid your treatment, here are some suggestions. You can ask your physician or healthcare team if a telemedicine appointment is possible. Of course, this won't help with your treatment visits, but if there's a follow-up visit that only requires speaking to your provider about results or treatment plans, this might be a viable option. You could also consider getting routine blood work done at a lab in your community rather than traveling all the way to your treatment center or hospital. And again, ask your healthcare team for help in arranging this. You might also talk to your human resources department about whether your workplace or the state that you live in offers short-term disability benefits if you're unable to work for a certain period of time. Depending on your type of cancer, it may qualify as a disability under the ADA or Americans with Disabilities Act. You might be eligible for workplace accommodations so that you can continue to work while you're undergoing treatment, but with some modifications, and that can include schedule modifications. Or your work setting may qualify for FMLA, or the Family Medical Leave Act, which typically consists of about 12 weeks of leave without risk of losing your job, and it can be used intermittently, for example, in hourly or daily increments rather than all at once. It is important to note, however, that FMLA is unpaid and does require you to use your accumulated paid time off in order to receive income during this period. You usually have to be at your current workplace for at least 1 year, and your workplace does have to be a qualified setting. Finally, if your medical team deems that you're unable to work for a period of 12 months or more, you may qualify for Social Security disability income, which, again, a social worker or a patient navigator can help you with. As always, advocate for yourself and ask your hospital resources, care managers, patient navigators, et cetera, about all of these resources and how to access them in your community. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Chi. That was an excellent presentation and very comprehensive, just a wonderful presentation. Thank you so much, and covered a lot of very important areas for our participants today. And our next speaker is Sarah Jaramillo, and Ms. Jaramillo is our Insights Program Coordinator at Cancer Care. She's also an oncology social worker, and she'll be addressing practical tips to cope with healthcare disparities, valuing your identity, key questions to ask your healthcare team, including referrals to dietitian, physical therapy, and other supportive services, health literacy, inviting trusted family friend to join your appointments with your doctor and healthcare team, how telehealth may help you with greater health equity, and guidelines for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, trusted family friend to join the appointment, quality of life concerns, and worry about open notes. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Jaramillo.
Thank you so much for the introduction. As mentioned prior, healthcare disparities amongst people diagnosed with cancer are continuing to increase, impacting those with several types of social identities, such as race, gender, socioeconomic status, age, and sexual orientation that are marginalized. It is important to know that as a cancer patient, you deserve the best possible care, no matter what identity you hold. Navigating disparities while being diagnosed or even as a caregiver can be difficult. However, there are tools that can make managing cancer care and disparities easier. The first step in advocating for yourself is being well-informed and educated with your health information. This may require you to find information about the type of cancer you have, the type of treatment, different information about healthcare settings, insurance, and general oncology knowledge. Cancer-specific organizations may be a great start to getting acquainted with oncology terms, diagnoses, treatments, and information specifically about cancer. So be sure to connect with reputable organizations as well as professionals first, as the internet can provide inadequate information or information that may need to be further explained by a professional. Having all the information you need about your diagnosis can help you make better decisions about your care. If you are newly diagnosed, it is imperative to ask your medical team specific questions about your diagnosis and treatment, including exploratory questions such as the type of testing that may be needed for the specific diagnosis, what are my treatment options, what is the recommended treatment, how long does this kind of treatment usually last, and what are the possible side effects of treatment. You may also ask how you have access to supportive services such as social workers, patient navigators, psychologists, financial navigators, and how may you connect with them. If you've already been in treatment and you're experiencing confusion about side effects or any concerns regarding your diagnosis, it is important to have all the information of what you've been experiencing with side effects or any adverse events. There are multiple ways to maximize your care, and some things that you may keep in mind that can help you getting the care you need include bringing a loved one to your appointments. Sometimes bringing a loved one to your appointments can help with easing anxiety, worry, and fear. Your loved one can also serve as a second pair of ears in case you miss any valuable information about your diagnosis, treatments, as well as future appointments. They can also help you ask the questions that you have. You may keep a health journal and document all of your experiences so you can clearly communicate with your team what is going on. In the healthcare journal, you may write down questions you have, your side effects, any adverse events you're experiencing, or any questions about appointments or further treatments. You may also ask for referrals to specialists. While medical professionals may refer you to other specialists, they may not do it automatically. So if you experience pain related to cancer, side effects, or issues with your nutrition, you may ask your medical team to refer you to a specialist. Some specialists that may consider getting referrals for include an oncologist, nutritionist, a dietitian, which can help you with dietary needs specific to what you experience. So if you're experiencing something such as taste or just any issues with nutrition, this may be a good idea to ask your medical team for a referral. Physical therapy can also help with recovery, neuropathy, and any quality of life concerns, specifically if you've experienced any major surgeries or need any type of recovery. Pain management and palliative care may also be a specialist that you can get referred for your oncologist. And this can help with any pain-related concerns or anything related to your quality of life. You may also have access to my chart and open notes, which increases accessibility to your test results. Please note that there may be access to these tests. It must still be reviewed by a doctor or a healthcare professional. Some people may experience increased levels of anxiety by receiving notifications, reviewing results, and attempting to interpret them. So please note that you may discuss this with your medical team and explore options if this has been impacting levels of anxiety or causing further worry. You may also schedule your telehealth appointments, and these appointments can help when you have any chronic concerns related to treatment or diagnoses. Telehealth appointments can also help with reducing transportation costs, especially for those living in rural areas or for those working while receiving treatment and may have limited availability. Navigating disparities can be challenging when dealing with a diagnosis if you have limited support or even experience any difficulty within your treatment. Inquire with your treatment center for a hospital social worker, a patient navigator, a nurse navigator, or a financial navigator. Each discipline is equipped with the tools to help you navigate the concerns and barriers that you have. You deserve to get the best care possible. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Grisales, Jamiro, just a wonderful presentation. A lot of important information for our participants, and I know there'll be a lot of questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. Thanks. Thank you very much. And I'm just going to say a few words about cancer care services. So Cancer Care is a national organization, and we provide free support services to people living with cancer. Many people call our HOPE line, 1-800-813-4673, and they often, when they call that HOPE line, an oncology social worker answers the phone. We have about 40 oncology social workers, and so they take turns answering the phone, so there's never any wait to speak to one. And usually people call with a specific question, like, I need help with the cost of transportation, or I need some counseling, or I need some help in talking to my child about cancer. So they usually have very specific questions, and the social worker usually addresses that question, and then they review with them all the services we offer. So what are those services? So we do offer, of course, practical, financial, and co-payment assistance, which can be very helpful, and we also help with food insecurity issues as well. We also offer a number of online support groups, and those support groups cover such a range of topics for many people, for both caregivers, LGBTQI plus community, young adults, older adults, and people living with very specific types of cancer or dealing with particular types of treatment side effects. And you can find a listing of all of those online groups at www.cancercare.org. Our website gives you all that information. Now, in addition to that, we also offer coping circles, which are support groups for people who are coping with different issues. And again, they have many different topics and many different issues that they address in those groups. We also offer resource navigation. So if we don't have the resource that you need when you call us, our social workers will work with you, our resource navigation team will work with you, and they will find a resource for you. And they'll stay with you until we have that resource for you. So it could be a resource either in your city, in your community, in your state, or a national resource, or a combination of all of those to help you to get the help that you need. And they'll stay with you until you have the services that you need. We also do offer these programs. We offer about 60 or 70 of these per year. And we also have a number of different publications that are available. And the publications are available. You can download them from our website. We also have fact sheets as well. And the publications and fact sheets are both in English and Spanish. So there's a number of different programs that we offer for you to take advantage of, and that's really just a snapshot of what we offer. And now we're going to move right on to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Krista to bring all of our speakers on board, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
And a question for Dr. Haviland. Can you talk about patients who are non-binary and how being in a gendered space may impact their comfort in seeking care?
This is a fantastic question. I'm so glad it was asked. I mean, I think that our medical system is set up to be very binary, period. So we're asking, what is your sex, but only giving two options, and we're not necessarily even asking what is your sex assigned at birth. So we're giving these binary options for people in a place where we know that gender expression, gender identity exist on a continuum. And so we have areas like, for example, that are called women's health or breast cancer centers. And the problem with these binary conceptions is that they alienate an entire population of people who may be gender expansive, may be non-binary. So we have areas where it's expected, or there may be an expectation from even our staff that women attend these centers only. People with all kinds of people with breast tissue or chest tissue have breast cancer and have chest cancer. And so we're not conducive to an environment that allows those populations to feel comfortable being treated. They're alienated. They're oftentimes asked and re-asked if they're in the right place. And so we create these environments that are not welcoming from the get-go, so that the trauma one may feel presenting to these areas is really quite profound, and actually can lead to not presenting for care. And so we also have gendered bathrooms. We have gendered ways of collecting urine samples in the bathroom. And these really alienate our patients. So we're not in a place where we're really providing that access to care that I was speaking about. So when I'm talking about all of these models for providing equitable care, this is what we have to look at. These are perfect examples of places we need to look. We're not looking at transgender people. We're not using language of people with chest or breast tissue, people with a uterus, people with cervix. We know that the human body comes in so many different ways, and there is no one right or one wrong way a human body comes out. So I think it's important that we account for the diversity in our human population in our cancer care environment, and we've not done a great job about that. And it's our, part of what I do is look to analyzing and looking at the physical environment that we are asking our patients to present in, and then making recommendations for those clinics to improve care for all. So I'm really glad you asked that question. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you for that wonderful answer, and I hope that really helps people to realize how to deal with these spaces. Thank you so much. And our next question is for Ms. Jaramillo. What resources or assistance programs are available to help with costs like transportation, co-pays, et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are several nonprofit organizations that can help. If it's for copay related, there are some copay organizations. Cancer Care has a copay foundation, and you can look on the website and see what funds are open, but you could also call us on our helpline. We provide several resources depending on the type of assistance needed. So I would encourage to also look into like disease specific organizations like the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. I know that there are several organizations that are disease specific that can also provide assistance. Local hospital social workers may also be able to provide more local resources. So if you don't have a hospital social worker, inquire and you can, you know, ask them if they can provide you with some resources, you know, even to any nonprofit organizations that are providing assistance. You could also ask for resources as well.
Thank you so much. Thank you. For Dr. Haviland, how are providers working on becoming more aware of and identifying the barriers to accessing health care that people of color uniquely face? Do you know of any institutions or organizations that are holding space for these discussions?
Absolutely, I do. I think, you know, in my institution, I know that in many institutions, part of strategic plans are health equity plans, which do address inequities in race, ethnicity, language, spoken. And many of these different vulnerabilities are being looked at, and initiatives such as directed research is occurring in these areas. Looking at providers' education about racism, bias, implicit, explicit bias, microaggressions are being undertaken. And I think that, you know, microaggressions in general are an area that really need to be looked at and educated providers about. I think so often that's an area that's overlooked, and we need to have role-playing situations, and we need to acknowledge our own biases and where we come from and why we have them so that we can change. And I do know that institutions are making a move towards, healthcare institutions are making a move towards addressing these. And we're also being, luckily being pushed to do this by the Center for Medicaid, Medicare. So I think this is good. We're having requirements from our regulatory bodies in the United States, and that can only help, well, can hopefully help, I won't say can only help, but can hopefully help with addressing and having the need to focus on these inequities as opposed to just pushing them off the scene or checking a box saying, okay, we've done this, but actually really employing outside consulting and firms to that know how to do this well, to improving our knowledge about these inequities.
Excellent, thank you. And Ms. Jaramillo, how can I advocate with my healthcare team to make sure I'm getting the best care possible?
Yeah, so that is a loaded question that I could probably spend a lot of time on. But in short, I think that the nature is feeling comfortable with your medical team. If you don't feel comfortable with your medical team, it is unlikely that you'll be willing to ask questions or share with them if something doesn't sit right with you. And so ensuring that you feel comfortable with your medical team can be the first step. And ways to explore that would be, you know, how do you feel when you're in an appointment? Do you feel rushed? Do you feel like you can ask questions, right? And if the answers are no to all of those questions, then that may indicate that you don't feel as comfortable with your medical team. So trying to reflect on that initially, but then also, you know, once you have that solid foundation, really sharing with your medical team some of the challenges you're having, even if they're not health-related, right? So if you're having a difficulty getting to your appointments, that definitely will impact your treatment, right? Because you may not be able to go to your treatment. So that factor is important to share with your medical team, because they may, one, be able to refer you to a social worker or a navigator that can help with that, or they can provide you with the resources if they don't have hospital social workers in the treatment center. And so in short, just ensuring that you feel comfortable with your medical team, that is the first step. And then also just knowing about your diagnoses, your treatment, and how you're experiencing all of it.
Excellent. And kind of a related question for Ms. Germano as well. How do organizations that are working to improve health equity measure their success?
I'm sorry, is that for me?
Yes, it is. It's kind of related but slightly different. How do organizations that are working to improve health equity measure their success?
Yeah, so measuring the success would be, you know, by looking at how many people are able to, one, advocate for themselves, or also just the information that they provide. So for example, in cancer care, we provide a bunch of publications and information about cancer, right? And so measuring, you know, how many people are inquiring for those publications, how many people are using our services, and what they're needing the services for.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And for Dr. Haviland, as a professional in health education, I want to create more discussion around healthcare disparities, but I'm unsure of where to start. What resources should I look into for more information around the topic, and do you have any tips on how to relay this information to those who might not understand?
Great question again.
It's a great question.
It is very tough, yes. You know, it is so tough sometimes. I was talking about this the other day. Sometimes you can feel like you can feel isolated and alone in this work because oftentimes there aren't a large amount of people doing the work, which is shocking to me, honestly. But I do think finding people within your organization that are also working towards equability and quality and working towards making our healthcare environment more equitable. So finding people that are geared towards the same outcomes. And then, you know, the question also asked about resources. I think if you start by, I mean, for my own work in LGBTQI plus resources, I use Safe Zone Training. It's a great resource. There's also the National LGBT Cancer Network, which is a great one. And looking at some of the new, the enhancing oncology model, the health equity model that's been released by CMS is a great model to look at the different areas in need of work and health equity. You know, there's a lot out there, and I think when you're asking what do you look for, that's a tough question. It depends on what area you're looking at, and then also how do you leverage the information that you learn to provide and get key stakeholders' ears. I think starting small, you know, talking about microaggressions is a great way and their effect on people and the high stress levels and the minority stress model of care and framework for what happens when we experience stress in our lives to our health outcomes. Well, when we have stress, we have poor health outcomes. So utilizing those data, talking about that initially. So stress is caused by, you know, by discrimination from providers, by treatment that is not safe from providers. So starting in that way, I think is a good model. And I'm always open and happy to talk further about different places to obtain the information and ways to influence your healthcare leaders.
Excellent. And I just want to let everybody know that all the resources we've mentioned during the program today and others that we may come up with you'll be getting a SurveyMonkey in about a week from this program. And in that SurveyMonkey, it's an evaluation of the program itself. But also, we will include all the resources that we mentioned during the program today. So I know you've been furiously writing down resources that have been given out, but you'll also be getting them in the SurveyMonkey as well. And a question from Mr. Merlo. I know my mother is unhappy with her care because of the discrimination and microaggressions she faces from her provider, but she won't bring it up. How can I advise her to advocate for herself or even seek out alternative providers?
That is a great question that, you know, unfortunately, I hear this often with patients and caregivers that I work with, and it must be really difficult to have to worry about that while also worrying about treatment. But one of the things that you can ask is, one, explore with your mom, you know, what are some of her hesitations? A lot of people have a fear that medical teams may retaliate, right? So just inquiring further and then maybe seeing if you can advocate on her behalf if she feels comfortable, right? So if you can attend an appointment with her, right, and speak to the medical team and, you know, bring that concern forth, right? And then asking for a second opinion. Second opinion is something that is very common that we encourage always, right? And not being comfortable with your medical team is definitely a reason to also explore second opinions. So if you can, speak with your mom and see, you know, if that's something that you can help with, if you're able to, and then going to appointments with her. Because oftentimes it can be difficult to advocate for yourself as a cancer patient, and so a lot of caregivers do the advocating as well.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And the question for Dr. Haviland, how do you go about setting up a multidisciplinary team when members are not with the same facility?
I'm not sure I fully understand the question.
I'll repeat it. How do you go about setting up a multidisciplinary team when members are not with the same facility? We have that going on today, but you want to comment?
No, I'm just trying to think it through a bit. I think it depends on the barriers that you're facing, because I'm not quite sure of the specific scenario, but really, if you're, you know, we have forums like this, exactly. We have forums where, you know, we do have Zoom today. We do have these new ways of communicating with people where we can get together in a room online, and most of us do have some type of way of getting together, whether it be on the phone in a conference call type environment or in a Zoom call with our video type environment. But, you know, we've done or I've been a part of many different teaching initiatives with facilities all throughout Africa, all throughout different areas. And I think that sharing information and talking and learning from each other, what are the resources one has? What are the resources certain facilities have? How can we work together? How can we utilize resources and then make some recommendations? You know, it really, when it comes down to it, what really matters is that we are, you know, addressing human needs and looking at what each human needs to be able to be successful in their treatment. So coming together to talk about those needs and listening to each other would be my advice in forming multidisciplinary teams.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. And this question I'm going to address is an undocumented immigrant living with liver cancer. I'm afraid to seek medical treatment. Is there any hope for me? And I just want to say that we're doing a program on the treatment of liver cancer on June 24th. And I think that'd be that's a good program for you to listen to. It's coming up soon. And of course, there's hope for you to get care. The particular speakers are very much aware of these issues, and I think would be able to address this for you. So please do try to sign up for that program, and we will also try to reach out to you so that you're sure to be on the program. And now I'm just going to ask our speakers to just give the takeaway from today's program. So I'm going to ask Dr. Haviland to go first and then Dr. Jaramillo to go second.
Great, thanks. I think remembering that healthcare inequities do exist, are present, and that your voice does matter, and that there are certain things we are doing as healthcare institutions to try to improve this this care, this inequitable care, by creating healthcare equity strategies to address issues and to focus on targeted interventions for all of you, for our patients, for our caregivers, for families of choice. And if you feel it, don't ignore it. If you're feeling there's something off about a certain an interaction with a provider, you're probably right. There may be something off, and pay attention to that. And see how, if there are ways you can talk to that provider about the feelings you have, if you can talk to other resources, talk to other people about the feelings you have, and see what available options there are for you. And reach out to community organizations wherever you are to feel supported. Thanks.
Thank you very much. That's an excellent point. That, you know, you're hearing today that there are organizations out there that can support you, and so you want to reach out to those organizations to help you. And I'm going to ask also Ms. Jaramillo to also provide a takeaway as well for today's program.
Sure. So navigating disparities can be challenging, and it's a job that cannot be done alone. Healthcare professionals have an ethical responsibility to address disparities and how it impacts individuals. And although there is an ethical responsibility for professionals, that may not be the real-time experience for individuals diagnosed and their loved ones. So just know that you deserve the best treatment, the best care, and learning more about your health, diagnoses, systems, insurance, that can help empower you or your loved one to advocate for the cancer care that you deserve. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I want to thank our speakers. You've really been phenomenal on today's program, and I want to thank our participants for really asking such great questions. Although we have done a program in the past, I have to say this program far exceeds what we've done before, based on both the questions asked and our speakers, really just terrific speakers today, and terrific participants. Now, because of the number of people on the call today, we weren't able to take everyone's questions, so I do want to comment on that. For those of you who either asked a question or have a question that you would like to ask or in queue, or a question that you perhaps will ask your physician in the future, please take your questions back to your treating healthcare team. Of course, they know you the best. And also, you've learned some things today that you can use with your healthcare team. And you also can make choices about whether you stay with that particular healthcare team or whether you choose to select a team that's more responsive to your needs. So again, it's really important that you not be afraid of your healthcare team, although I know people often are. Everybody probably is to some extent. But I think that we're talking about a different type of concern about a healthcare team that's perhaps not always responsive to your particular needs. And that is important, that you find the right team for you. And I think that with the resources we're going to give you today and the people you've heard speaking today, you certainly please feel free to contact Cancer Care, and we will be giving you a lot of other resources to contact as well. So again, I want to wish you all a very fine day, and thank you all for your participation on today's program. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.